Now, I've studied over the last 20 years, like, you know, Mormonism, Jehovah's Witnesses, Islam, and things like that, quite a bit. And I really kind of thought, and atheism and things like that, I really kind of thought that that was the biggest concern for the church. And I've changed my mind quite a bit. I think right now, really the ideas that are flowing out of postmodernism, that's what is affecting us the most right now. So we're gonna really focus on that today. What postmodernism is and some of its effects that you're gonna recognize when we get to this. Okay, some of it you're gonna recognize probably right up front. Like if you've ever heard someone say, "Well, that's just your truth," you know. Well, that comes from this idea, all right, or this idea of being skeptical of everything that comes from postmodernism. So we're going to be focusing in on that here as we study through this. Okay, so I've again simplified it here, and if you have any questions as we're going through this, you know, feel free to ask here. But let me open this up in prayer, and then we can get started. Okay. Father, again, thank you for your goodness to us. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to come together as a body. And we appreciate this freedom that we do have to come and worship together. Pray for our time together this morning. Give us clear thinking and give me clear words. May your name be honored. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so beginning here, let me get my notes. Again, you have your review there for your handout. You can just review the last few weeks. But we're going to be this this term, or this little sentence here, that ideas have consequences. So there was a book that was written 1948 by a man named Richard Weaver called Ideas Have Consequences. You can see the picture there on the screen. But the premise of his book was that, this was written 1948, so this was quite a while ago. But he was concerned about the way things were going in the world and in the West. And so he said that the turmoil, the things that were wrong in the world, were because of the rise of relativism over absolute reality. So that people believing in, again, that's just your truth, that he was saying that was causing the issues that were going on in the world. And so he wrote that book. Well, Scripture says kind of the same thing, doesn't it, in different places. Like Colossians 2:8 says, "See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty conceit, according to human tradition, according to the elemental things of the world, and not according to Christ." Romans 1:28-32, if you've recognized that and read through that, I'm sure you probably have. But it says, "And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind, to do what ought not to be done. Though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them." And actually, if you read through Romans chapter 1, what you see is this denial of God results in just chaos, really. And so we see that is taking place today all around us. So we're going to be talking about here in this session, this class, about in a lot of ways how we've gotten to where we're at. And you're going to see at the end some things that you've probably recognize from the news and maybe from talks with other people, from neighbors, from just the world today as we see it. You're going to probably recognize some of these things. All right. But let's begin here by talking about what the difference is between objective knowledge and subjective knowledge is. So I have a graph on your screen, but who can tell me, I mean, if you can, could you succinctly describe to me what's the difference between objective knowledge and subjective knowledge?
Objective is something that you can see, touch, feel, and then like you can't see it. They can't palpable.
Okay.
And subjective is something like, it's more like a feeling, something like you can't really see, but you can't put your finger on it, but it's like just a feeling.
Right. So it's based, this subjective knowledge, we might say, is based on the person viewing it. It's kind of based on opinion, more or less. Right, and an objective, yes, generally we think of objective as like there's a hard concrete something that you're talking about. But it's really even deeper than that. It's objective in the sense that it actually has an actual meaning to it. So this is the way that I wrote it down. Objective knowledge is knowledge that is true and accurate based on its correspondence with the object in question. Okay? I'll say that again. It's knowledge that is true and accurate based on its correspondence with the object in question. So as you see on the screen here, the figure on the left says these are oranges. You can see the oranges here. Now, this is objective knowledge because those are oranges. And so when this man is thinking this thought, these are oranges, he's thinking an objectively true thing, not because he's thinking it, but because those really are oranges. There's something that exists in this universe, and that's really what it is. Subjective knowledge is knowledge that is considered true and accurate based on the subject observing the object rather than its correspondence with the object itself. So we see the figure on the right now, we're looking at the same oranges saying, I love oranges. Okay? Now, that's based on him. Some people don't love oranges. This person does love oranges. So it's subjective in that sense. Now there's one sense where we would say yes, but it's objective for him because he actually does. It's true that he does love oranges, right? But his love for oranges is not a universal truth. His love of oranges is a truth for him. Okay. Now there's nothing wrong with either one of these things. Like when we describe it, that one's not right and the other's not wrong. The problem runs into the fact, are we going to change what those oranges are based on the subjective knowledge? All right, that's where the problem comes, and we're going to be getting to that. And so this is what, now we get to postmodernism, okay? And this is what postmodernism would say. That there is no objective knowledge, since no one has unbiased knowledge. So skepticism, then, is the only knowledge which one can know, which one can actually know. So it's all about skepticism, all right? So when we say, this is maybe esoteric, maybe way out there for you, but so then when we say these are oranges, then the postmodernist says, well, how do you know? How do you know those are oranges? Maybe you say they're oranges, and somebody just picked to say that they're oranges, but maybe they're not oranges. You say they're sweet, but how do you know they're sweet? You know, and that might sound a little bit silly to us as we're talking about it, but as we continue to walk through this lesson, you're going to see, but that's exactly where we're at in the world today. All right. Only, I will just say, when you get to postmodern knowledge or skepticism, no one can be truly this way. Because they can't live their life completely this way, as much as they might want to. So that's why initially I was going to cover Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormonism this week, which is a lot to cover for one lesson anyway. But here's why I've chosen not to do that. Not because that's not important, and I think if, you know, once we get back to normal here, for church, I really want to do that because I do think that's an important thing. But see, you can have a conversation with a Jehovah's Witness. You can have a conversation with a Mormon because they actually do believe in objective knowledge. As a matter of fact, when a Jehovah's Witness comes to your door, he's going to have his Bible in his hand and he's going to want to show you why his view is true and your view is false. Right? And I've had conversations with them. You can go in their Bible and you can agree or disagree with them, and you can point it out to them. Now, they may not change their mind, but they still agree. We have an agreement. There is such a thing as truth, and such a thing as not true. All right? But today, that's not the world we live in, and you can look around and see that. So that a man can say he's a woman, and everyone else has to go along with it. And not just go along with it, but affirm it. Right? So we're going to talk about, again, where that comes from. So let's just begin here with postmodernism by beginning with really what you say, well, postmodern, well, then what's modern? What does that mean? Well, modernism is really the idea of, you think of the Enlightenment period, all right? So I have a caption up here on your screen, just one caption of the Enlightenment. So I'm just going to give you five core beliefs of modernism. That way this will help you to understand now how we've gotten beyond that today. All right, now when I say we, I don't mean us here. You can't be a Christian and be truly postmodern, okay? Because you're denying that there's such a thing as, you can't land anywhere if you're truly postmodern. But Christian, you can't be a Christian if you're not landing somewhere, right? We have to have foundational truths. So here's the first one. Modernist thought had a high level of confidence in human reason and in the human ability to know with certainty. So human reason, if you want to boil it down, it had to do with human reason. So they had a high level of confidence in human reason and in the ability to know with certainty, based on human reason. All right. Now, I will say that the Enlightenment was not focused on God. As a matter of fact, a lot of them denied that there was a God. They wanted to get to the pinnacle of knowledge without God. Most of them. All right. Okay. Number two, modernists or Enlightenment thinkers were committed to the widespread progress they thought science made possible. So reason was the first step, and they believed that science was the way to train your reason to know truth, to get to this ultimate truth. Okay? And again, we don't disagree with that in many ways, that science is very useful. Reason is very, very useful. I mean, God himself says in Isaiah, for instance, come, let us reason together. God gave us reason. So we don't disagree with these things, but you just have to remember these were apart from God, and these were like ultimate points here. Okay, number three, many Enlightenment or modernist figures, following the lead of John Locke, rejected the doctrine of original sin as repugnant to human reason. So they rejected original sin. Okay, so most of them thought, Jean-Jacques Rousseau was a philosopher, and he believed that, in essence, we were born good and society corrupted us, but that we're born naturally good. And so they rejected the doctrine of original sin. Number four, the majority of Enlightenment intellectuals saw Western culture as the pinnacle of modern civilization. Okay, so aside from Asian culture, aside from South American culture, aside from African culture, aside from any other cultures in the world, they believed that Western culture was the pinnacle. And then number five, many Enlightenment figures either rejected or radically modified traditional Christianity. Either rejected or radically modified traditional Christianity. So if you've heard of deism, Benjamin Franklin was a deist, and others, where they believed that there was a God, and he was the watchmaker, the clockmaker who built the clock, wound it up, and lets it run, but he doesn't interact with it. It's just there. And so that's one example of that. All right. So, in essence, a revised way that a modernist might write Psalm 19:1 is, "The heavens declare the glory of man," which it actually says, "The heavens declare the glory of God." All right. So that would be their thinking. All right. So many devotees of reason, science, and progress were discouraged by the lack of the expected arc towards utopia. They thought that this reason and science was going to move society towards utopia. But it wasn't happening, right? And you can think of like the French Revolution as an example, right, of things. And then just wars in general, and the fact that there was still poverty, there was still a lot of suffering that was going on in the world. And so there's lots of other thinkers, but I'm going to focus on the ones who've impacted kind of what we're seeing today. Okay, and so one such person was Karl Marx, if you've heard his name, Karl Marx. All right, and he lived 1818 to 1883. All right, and this is what he taught, believed, and I've very much succinctly compiled this paraphrased this, I guess you could say, because it is a lot more in depth than this, and you can read his writings to see. But this is the basis of it. So he was concerned that the product of the Enlightenment was not perfecting the human condition. He looked around and he saw this isn't perfecting the human condition. And in many ways, it seemed to be getting worse. So Karl Marx claimed to find the key. It was because the powerless were unable to free themselves from the chains of the powerful. His goal then was to wake up the masses of oppressed to their oppression and then unite them to overthrow their oppressors. So using all the same tools, he was a part of the Enlightenment. He was a modernist thinker who said, the reason that science wasn't perfecting the human condition was because those mean oppressors were keeping the oppressed down. Now, there was some truth to that. Like, that's always been the case since the history of the world. Sinners always sin, and so we see that that's taken place in the world. But he thought that was the key to everything. And so these oppressors were the rulers, the wealthy capitalists, and the church. And again, if you look in history, he wasn't completely wrong about that. It's not like that wasn't true. Most things, and I would say pretty much everything, in order to gain a footing, there's got to be some truth to it. If it's just all falsehood, nobody's going to believe it, right? There's got to be something to grab onto that's going to get people, you know, their attention and their desire to want to follow that. Marx believed that the church used its religion for what Marx termed the opiate of the masses. The opiate of the masses, if you've heard that term before. In other words, it used its rules, its regulations, its threats of hell and promises of heaven to keep the people under submission. Right? You can read, for instance, in his Communist Manifesto, you can read some of, and Das Kapital is another one that he wrote. And so again, the key here, and I think I had some notes here. Yeah, key Marx's focus is on the oppressed versus the oppressor, using Enlightenment principles, using those same principles that we had listed above, number 1 through 5. He believed that using those principles, you needed to focus, though, on the oppressed versus the oppressor in the midst of all that. All right, so human emancipation became his aim. He believed that the foundations of the Enlightenment were sufficient to ultimate progress, but that these foundations were undermined by the oppressors to their own advantage. And he believed that there should be this sudden revolution of the proletariat to the bourgeois, and that you would be able to say it better than I can. But he believed that basically the workers needed to come together, unite. There would be this sudden revolution, and you can see some instances where that took place. You think of Russia, you know, the Soviet Union, Russia, and then China, and some other places like that. And that's what he believed. All right, but let's fast forward a little bit. So, but as time went on, the things that Marx taught weren't gaining the kind of ground that some wanted it to get. You know, they wanted to gain more ground. They couldn't understand why. Now we had the Enlightenment, the modernist thinkers, and then you had Marx come along, but even his thoughts weren't gaining the traction and improving things as many thought they should. All right, and these were believers in Marx. So you can term this Marxism 2.0. These men were Marxists, these philosophers and thinkers here, and I just gave you some examples of them listed up here. And you can read these guys yourself if you're so interested, but these were philosophers that came together. So this is found at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany in 1923. And this school called, and we see, did I have it? The Frankfurt School, right? In Frankfurt, Germany in 1923. And this was an attached institute to this Goethe University. This institute was founded with the aim of developing Marxist studies in Germany. The Nazis forced its closure in 1933, and the institute was moved to Columbia University in New York City. The theory that was produced by the thinkers in this institute is now popularly known as critical theory. So if you've heard this term, critical theory, this is where this comes from, all right? Now, what we have today is derivative of what these guys were thinking. And they're not completely wrong. I mean, they have some good insights, I think, you know, not perfect, and they're not Christian, but I think there's some good things that they're noticing that, like, you don't just throw everything out. There's some things about it that, you know, just like a lot of things I would say, right? So critical theory is basically they're reacting to the failures of Marxism to address the massively increasing death and oppression of the early and mid-20th century. These academic thinkers and the ones I've got on the screen here, who were in agreement with Marxist ideology, began to critique the foundations of knowledge itself. So key critical theory focus is, again, on the oppressed versus the oppressor. But now, instead of just believing all the Enlightenment thinking, they said, wait a second, we're going to start focusing on knowledge itself, because maybe there's something wrong with what we call knowledge. Maybe this oppressor versus the oppression goes a lot deeper than that, so that the oppressors are keeping the oppressed down with knowledge itself. All right? So this is kind of the train. You can see it building along. And again, I'm leaving out other people that are involved in this process. Not everybody, but I'm trying to get to the main point here that we're going to get to today. All right? So the questions these philosophers asked was, why was Marxism not effective? The traditional theory of modernity, which was utilized in Marxism, was found to be neither neutral nor as reflective as its advocates tended to believe. Social interests were hidden within the philosophical discourse. A new tool, critical theory, was required to demonstrate how the premises of contending philosophical outlooks were tainted by the values of the existing order. So this is essentially what they said. The master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. They believe that the master, those who are keeping the oppressed down, utilized everything that you see in all knowledge, all ways of talking, everything, to keep the oppressed down, and the oppressed didn't even know it. All right? So as traditionally science and reason were used to examine problems in society, critical theory explicitly aims to examine all the social discourses that go on among everyone to see which ways are the oppressed keeping the oppressors keeping the oppressed down. All right, this is what they were focused on. So if you've heard the term microaggression, and you're like, what in the world? Somebody getting their feelings hurt so easily by these microaggressions. That all stems from this, right? So that really, if you take this all the way out and into where we're at today, someone that feels microaggressed against is saying, you're using your language to oppress me, right? So A critical theory is chiefly concerned with revealing hidden biases and under-examined assumptions, usually by pointing out what have been termed problematics, which are ways in which society and the systems that it operates upon are going wrong. So that's what it what their focus is. So, and you see this from the Princess Bride here, I do not think it means what you think it means, if you've seen that movie. And that's what they're saying. I don't think you think it means what you think it means. They're saying it means something else. It's a tool that's being used, right? Now, building on this, then you had three French philosophers that came along, Jacques Derrida, Michel Foucault, and Jean-Francois Lyotard. And these are the ones that we're going to focus here on today. Because they're building on this critical theory, and they come along. Jacques Derrida, if you've heard of the term deconstruction or deconstructionism, he's kind of the founder and popularizer of this idea. All right. So generally speaking, he taught that essentially words have no objective meanings. Since meanings are derived subjectively, he said, then in order to truly understand words and sentences, one must get beneath to deconstruct all biases used in defining words. Okay, that might sound a little bit crazy. He's not completely off base. Like, what he's saying isn't completely untrue. Because there's some sense, like, for instance, we had a picture of an orange. Well, who determined that's an orange? Who determined that? Well, at some point in time, some people had to determine, we're going to call that an orange versus a pumpernickel or something, right? I mean, they determined that. So there's some truth to that. But that doesn't mean that's not actually an orange, what we know as an orange. That's still an orange. We use the word orange to describe it, though, all right? So it's not that he's completely off base, and some of these guys actually also get their thinkings from Nietzsche. If you've ever read any of Nietzsche, they really got a lot of their traction from what he was writing too. So Foucault, expanding on these theories, taught that since words have no meanings or have no objective meaning, then knowledge itself, the knowledge that these words convey, is really not in non-existence. There's no objective knowledge. Since you can't really know what the words mean, then the words you put together to create knowledge can't really have a meaning either. We can't really know what it is. He taught that those in power are the ones who control knowledge by controlling language. Essentially, his theory was power equals knowledge. So the ones who are in power, they get to control what we consider is true knowledge. Okay? This is going to sound crazy to you, and we're going to talk about this in a minute. So much so that even Purdue University now is starting to push, and there's a book produced by Purdue University for their engineering department where they're pushing this new idea of math so that you have to take other ways of doing math, like emotions. You have to take emotions into math. Like, that has to be, and they've a new term for it, mathematics with an X at the end. Instead of T-I-C-S at the end, it's T-X, mathematics, right? I'm not making this up. I'm going to be reading a little bit of, you're looking at me like it's crazy, but this is really going on. Okay, then Lyotard says this, following the lack of objective meanings of words and even knowledge itself, Lyotard then taught that the meta-narratives that are taught, the big stories of how things really are, not just knowledge of what this is and what that is, but the big stories of why we're here, what's the purpose and everything, all of that too is subjective. We can't really know what it is, right? So you can see how that was built. In other words, the way that a society believes things really are and the way things ought to be are only subjective stories invented by the powerful to keep their power. In other words, is it really true that there's men and women in the world? Or is it true that there's any variation of whatever? Is it really true that a man is only supposed to marry a woman? I mean, this is where we've gotten today. To say that Lyotard thought that, maybe he didn't, but we don't know. But that's where it's gotten today, and this is what he's building. And so then you get this. This is where postmodernism comes from. So postmodernism is characterized then by broad skepticism, subjectivism, or relativism. So it's a general suspicion of reason and an acute sensitivity to the role of ideology in asserting and maintaining political and economic power. And again, I'm going to say, these aren't completely untrue. All right? So think about this for a second. If someone is pro-life, what does many on the left say, call someone who's pro-life? Today. They don't call them, generally they don't say they're pro-life. What do they say? anti-choicers. And what are they? Pro-choice. Well, what have you just done there? Because they've changed the wording to fit so that it sounds like, who's against choice? Are you anybody that you know against choice? We're all for choice, right? It's just that doesn't describe what kind of choice you're talking about. And so we're all for choice, so you change the way you describe it in order to influence culture. And so then people are like, well, yeah, I'm for choice, without thinking through exactly what that means. So you can just see one example of that playing out. All right? And so they're saying, we can see an effect. I just gave you an example of the way things are today. But they were saying, and this is what's being continued said, is that that's how things have always been worded, but in a way to oppress the people that are downtrodden. Right? And again, this isn't completely untrue. That has taken place. Okay, so the key postmodern focus is deconstruction through skepticism. And by the way, nobody chuckled when you saw this. I thought it was funny. Maybe you've seen it before.
No.
Or I just can't see you chuckling, I guess, because you...
I didn't get it.
Was that actually on the internet?
Yeah, I found this on the internet.
Don't believe it.
It says, don't believe everything you read on the internet just because there's a picture with a quote next to it. And for those of you online, there's a picture of Abraham Lincoln, and it's signed Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, makes it sound like he said that.
Well, except for the internet part.
Yeah. And the picture. Of course, that's the whole point, right? That's the whole point in that there. Okay, so the resulting ideology of critical theory is this postmodernism, which acts as an acid on all objective knowledge. The aim is to deconstruct all knowledge, to get down to the basics, because we don't, you know, we think we know, and we need to find a way, and that's this tool of critical theory to get down our critical theory, then using this postmodern ideology of deconstructionism deconstructs everything. All right? And again, it's not completely untrue. When even when you're a Bible scholar and you're studying Scripture, you want to figure out what was taking place when Timothy was written. Why did he write Timothy? Why did Paul write Timothy? Who is he writing to? What was Timothy like? So that you can understand what is meant by the letter to Timothy. So there's some truth to this. Like, you're deconstructing what you might think it means, because we can assume that we think we know what it means and we don't. So there's some truth to this. It's just where it's gotten today. So knowledge, truth, meaning, and morality are culturally constructed, they believe, and relative products, and that these are relative products of individual cultures, none of which possess the necessary tools or terms to evaluate the others. So they even believe that different cultures can't judge each other because we don't have the tools to be judging each other, because we don't know. You'd have to deconstruct all the knowledges that cultures are pushing on each other. And if you're the dominant culture, then you're the one pushing your view on everybody else. And again, it's not completely untrue. I'm going to give you some examples here in just a minute. Now, deconstructionism, though, only does one thing. It just tears down. That's all it does. It only has the power to tear down. Right? And so the thinkers over time, and especially those who were pushing for change, realized that's all skepticism is going to do. If you just keep being skeptical, you're just going to have nothing left. It's going to be a puddle of nothing, because there's no foundation anymore. You don't have anything to build on. Okay. Well, some thinkers came along then and started using what many have termed, in one author in particular, called applied postmodernism. So now you got to figure out a way to reconstruct in a way that's going to remake society so that the oppressors can no longer keep the oppressed down. And there's a term for this: social justice. You heard AJ mention that this morning. Now, we're not opposed to social justice, or at least we ought not to be as Christians. right? If you mean, and I gave two definitions of social justice. Let's start with the bottom one. If you mean social justice as a general term to describe justice in a society, which is given to all equally, then we would say, yes, we're for that. We are for that, or we ought to be as Christians. In a Christian sense, one might describe this as biblical justice, a justice which is not partial to the poor nor deferential to the great. That's what we ought to be for. But there is a movement now called the social justice movement. Capital S, capital J. This refers to a very specific doctrinal interpretation of the meaning of social justice and means of achieving it, while prescribing a strict identifiable orthodoxy around that term. If you've seen signs in people's yards, you know, that we believe these things, they're getting that from this teaching. They're getting those from them. And again, you can read the sign. I taught some of this for the high schoolers. And as you read through those signs, you can say, depending on what you mean, I could just about say yes to all those, depending on what you mean by the sign. It's just that's not what the signs mean. So a Christian can be very well-meaning and say, I agree with that one, I agree with that one, I agree with that one, not understanding that what they mean by that is maybe not what you mean by that, right? The social justice movement, all right? And this is what makes it so convoluted too as Christians, because we are for social justice. And we have this impulse of wanting true justice, all right? So this is what social justice does. It reconstructs discourse in a way that changes the power dynamic in a society from the current oppressors to those who are oppressed. So it switches. Now the oppressed have the power instead of the oppressors. Now, first thing I said I wanted to do is define oppression. So oppression, from Merriam-Webster, is simply unjust or cruel exercise of authority or power. Unjust or cruel exercise of authority or power. And again, we're opposed to that kind of oppression. Social justice, though, conflates disparities or differences between groups with injustice and oppression. Wherever disparities exist between groups, social justice assumes that the cause must lie with systemic or institutional oppression of one sort or another. Now, again, sometimes it does lie in that. I want to point that out. Sometimes it's true, but that's not what they're saying. They're saying it must. It must be if two groups do not have exactly the same outcome, whatever it is, whether it's the homosexual community versus the straight community, right? If it's black versus white, if it's male versus female, no matter what it is, if one group in any area has a disparity, it must be because of oppression, right? And they believe that oppression is embedded in the unquestioned norms, habits, and symbols. All right? So we're going to talk, and I've got a half an hour to get through the rest of this here. But we're going to talk about really what are the main now theories that have stemmed out of critical theory. All right? And so this critical theory in action. We have this post-colonial theory. And by the way, these are all theories that are being taught in universities and in most universities, for sure in the United States and in the West. But in the United States, most universities are teaching these things, all right, in their classes and in their courses. Post-colonial theory, queer theory. By the way, I didn't name these. These are what they are actually called. Critical race theory, feminism and gender studies, disability and fat studies, and then if you've heard this term intersectionality, it's becoming more and more of a common term. That's what we're going to be talking about at the end. That's kind of the last thing here that we'll focus on as far as these go. Okay, so I'm just going to give you some examples here. So let me read this here. We'll start with post-colonial theory. And I want to just say at the beginning, too, that there's a lot of overlap between these different theories, and there's even some contradictions between some of them, all right? So you have like the feminist studies and the gender studies have started to butt heads because the feminists have been around for a while. And they're saying, you know, look, females are not being treated equally. But now you have gender studies saying a guy can say he's a girl. And the feminists are like, well, hold on a second. I spent my life as a girl. You're a guy saying you're a girl. You don't know what it's like to face what I have. You're a Johnny come lately in this thing, and you're now wanting the same you know, you want to have this have same claim as we have. And so there's this battle between the different groups. But again, I said this is for the high school class. We'll let them fight amongst themselves. We're not going to worry about that. I'm just going to tell you what they are. So post-colonial theory says this. This concerns culture itself, all right? So this is an othering of different cultures. This is what they believe. This is what they teach, that the dominant culture others all other cultures. And again, there's truth in most of these things. There's some truth. So I don't want to say that, but it's just taking it as if it's the pinnacle of, it's the one standard. That's kind of what they're doing. It's the ultimate kind of standard. So they reject colonialists, control by one power over a dependent area or people. Right? They reject colonialist meta-narratives by focusing on the ways of speaking about things. Okay? So this is what they would say. The Western colonial mindset, this is what they would say our mindset is. Westerners are rational and scientific, while other groups are irrational and superstitious. Therefore, Westerners must rule over other groups. They say this is what the post-colonial theory says. They say that's what the Westerners say. Now, there's some truth in that. We can see in history there's some truth in that. And I'm sure there's some truth even today. The postmodern mindset comes in and says, the West has constructed the idea that rationality, science, and certain morals and ethics are good in order to perpetuate its own power and marginalize non-rational, non-scientific forms of knowledge production from elsewhere. So applied postmodern mindset or social justice says, therefore, we must now devalue white Western ways of knowing for belonging to white Westerners and promote other ones in order to equalize the balance of power. Okay, and that's what's taking place. Devalue the Western ways of knowing and elevate other ways of knowing. So I'm going to give some, I had some pictures and I'm going to give some examples here. There's some truth to what they're saying here. For instance, you can look at the picture on the left and say, is that hairstyle right? Or is it better? Or is it worse? It's none of the above. It's a completely acceptable hairstyle for this woman here, and there's nothing better or worse about that hairstyle than anyone else, right? So one culture can have a hairstyle just like that, and we say there's nothing moral or immoral or better or worse about that, all right? But we can see here on the right a picture in India. There's the Hindu custom of burning. When a husband would die, they would burn the wife on the funeral pyre of the husband. Now, we can see the left is a cultural picture. And we can say that cultural picture is no better or worse than any other cultural picture, right? But we can say the one on the right, well, there's a lot of cultural ideas that are a lot better than that one, right? We don't want wives to be thrown on the funeral pyre of their husbands while they're alive, right? So this post-colonial theory doesn't make that kind of a distinction. As Christians, we should be making that kind of a distinction. We should be looking and saying, we don't want to label another cultural practice as wrong if it's just another cultural practice. It's not right, it's not wrong, it's just what it is. And you can even appreciate some of those things. But then we do want to say, but there are cultural practices that are wrong, right? And we don't want to do them. And we could say, we have a cultural practice called abortion that we say is wrong, and we would hope that other countries would say, that's wrong, you shouldn't do that, right? So this is just one example, and then I have another one here. So this is about math. So 1 plus 2 equals, of course, 3. 2 plus 3 equals 5, and then we say that's math. That is math. That's the way you do it. Do we want to then to say, because other people might read bones, they might get their information that way, but we say, well, no, that's not a good way to get information. All right. So culturally, we can't say it's just simply cultural, because there are right ways and wrong ways to do math. All right. You don't want to be doing bone reading to figure math out. Right. That's not the ideal way to do that. All right. So Christian mindset says this: all humans are made in the image of God. We have the capacity to be rational and scientific, but individuals will vary widely. Therefore, all humans should have opportunities and freedoms. That's what we should be saying as Christians. But this post-colonial theory says, no, reject the Western culture and elevate all other cultures. All right, and that's where you get this cultural appropriation when you hear people saying that. And so, like, you know, one group can't culturally appropriate something from especially if you're the dominant group, you can't use anything from the groups that aren't the dominant group.
That's what I thought they were going to do with the hair, because some people, like, if some other group have their hair like that, they would say the same thing you just mentioned.
Yes, right, and that's one example. That would be culture. Or if you see too, like the tearing down of statues, that's another example of that. Is we're going to tear down this history. We're going to erase the history of these colonialists, all right? Now, again, some of them, I said this in the high school class, some of them probably shouldn't have had statues up to them in the first place. So we can all admit that, right? But a lot of the ones they're tearing down today, they maybe had their faults, but they were good men in lots of other ways, right? And so, and you don't want to erase history. You want to learn from history. So, and then here, I give an example of that in the book Engineering and Social Justice, published by Purdue University Press. We read many examples of social justice concepts that are sensitive to dynamics of difference, power, and privilege among people and culture groups. In the book, there's this recommendation that, quote, getting beyond views of truth as objective and absolute is the most fundamental change we need in engineering education. Because of its reliance on the Western idea of objectivity and proof, and also the disparate outcomes in education, mathematics is now called upon to draw upon indigenous worldviews to reconceptualize what mathematics is and how it is practiced. The solution? Mathematics, with an X. Shift. This is a shift from thinking of mathematics as a noun to mathematics as a verb, which honors other ways of coming to math answers. Now, you see, this starts to get really dangerous when you start going down that road. All right. Curricula using these similar concepts are under serious consideration for implementation in public schools at all levels in the Seattle area.
Can you kind of break that down into simple? I mean, how do you change mathematics? That? To make, like, to go from that to that?
Well, not specifically that, but that you want to incorporate, like, emotions, for instance, needs to be involved in it. Right, and you can't just use statistics, for instance. You need to figure out the way that people think and feel about those statistics. You need to take other...
Introducing feelings.
Yes, yeah. Introducing feelings into math.
Thinking of from, not that I'm an engineer, from an engineering standpoint, or building airplanes. Well, you have to use those numbers that are given to you to
right.
make things fit, you know. And, but that's not what everything you're talking
right.
about.
Right, well... Right, but they would say yes. Well, you actually do have to take in emotions and feelings and stuff into that.
So, like, are they saying, like, you know, I have a piece of metal that, and there's a 90-degree bend in the middle. Well, I'm not happy that, like, how does emotion play into that?
You're maybe describing a good point. They might say, well, it feels better if it's 95 degrees.
Yeah.
I mean, that might be where that's headed, right?
And I would be happier. I'm not happy with it at 90 degrees. I need it to be at 91 degrees.
Right. Or
so it, the relativism come into play.
Right. So relative.
I'd be happier if 1 + 2 = 1.
Right. I mean, that's kind of what it boils down to, or at least that's where the end of the road would lead us to. You know, one author said he doesn't think this is going to crash and burn. But his concern was what damage is going to be done in the meantime. Like he said, this is going to be around for that long.
How that could affect how statistics can represent.
Sure.
Something. I can see that.
Okay, so...
would become a lot less exact if we use that.
Yeah, and again, like this one author said, I don't... He said, I don't think this isn't going to be around a really long time. He said he's worried about the damage that can be done in the meantime. You know, and you can just imagine that. Okay, next, let's continue on with this. So next is queer theory. So this concerns the norms of sexuality and gender. So this is an othering of different sexual orientations and gender identity. So last, it was the othering of other cultures. This one is the othering of different sexual orientations and identities. So they reject the norm of heterosexuality and cisgendered identity. So cisgendered person is, I'm a male, I have a male's body, and I feel like I'm a male, so I'm cisgendered. If I had a male's body, but I feel like I'm a female, then I'm transgendered. Okay, that's what it means. Right? And so they say that all the cisgendered people in the West, because we're the dominant group, we have oppressed the minorities. We have oppressed the homosexuals, and we have oppressed the cisgender, the transgendered people. All right? They insist that society is structured of systems of power and privilege which create norms in sexuality and gender. Okay, so I don't have time to read through this whole thing, but I'm just going to tell you. So this is the postmodern mindset. The heterosexual and cisgendered majority has constructed the idea that heterosexuality and cisgendered identity are good in order to perpetuate its own power and marginalize homosexual and transgendered groups and individuals. So, applied postmodernism comes in, social justice, the big SJ comes in and says, therefore we must now devalue heterosexual cisgendered identity and promote homosexuality and transgenderism in order to equalize the balance of power. That's what you see going on today. That's exactly what you see going on. So you're devaluing of marriage, you're devaluing of the fact that I'm a man and you're a woman, right? You're devaluing all those things because we can be whatever we feel like we are.
Blur the line.
And it's because, they say, the dominant cultures have oppressed the oppressed culture. And that's the only reason we even think that there's no such thing. It's not really true that I'm a man and you're a woman. It's not really true. It's just we've believed that because the oppressed group has said that. All right? So my next picture. I'm sorry, go ahead.
The oppressor.
Did I have to say it backwards?
Yeah.
Okay, so the next picture here, I'm just going to run through this. This is, you've maybe seen this person before. And if you get on your phones right now and you type in health department, health secretary, don't type in any names. That's probably the first person that's going to pop up. I get on a regular basis updates from this person right here. Okay. So this is Dr. Rachel Levine. Rachel Levine is an American pediatrician currently serving as the Pennsylvania Secretary of Health. This is what it says online. She also serves as a professor of pediatrics and psychiatry at the Penn State College of Medicine. This is what the article says, was previously Pennsylvania's physician general, but she's a man. So imagine this. The director of the health department for a state is a man who believes he's a woman. Right? Now that's the fire chief who doesn't know what a fire looks like. Right? And so this is right today. Okay? And so this is where we've gotten. Too, right, and so one statement that you might hear too in this, from stemming out of this, is that love is love. You've heard that before, which sounds great, doesn't it? It's another way of utilizing language to convince, because love is love. I mean, it just love. I mean, it just sounds good. Of course, it doesn't really even mean anything. I mean, it's love is love. Cats are cats. Cars are cars. You know, what does that even mean? But we know it means something. What does it mean? What are they getting at when they say that?
You can love whoever you want.
You can love whoever you want. Do we disagree with that?
Maybe. Who are you in love with?
But if you see, again, it depends on what you mean. That's why when the signs say love is love, we say, well, yeah, it depends on what you mean. We should. I mean, I love my grandma. I said this.
What type of love?
Yeah. What type of love, right? And so they have a certain kind of love they have in mind. And it's all about sexual love. It's not about, because I love my grandma, but they're not saying I should be able to marry her. They're talking about something else entirely, right? Using queer criticism, this statement, love is love, now means that anyone who loves another person, regardless of sex or gender, should be allowed to marry them. They've redefined love, which now just generally means a sexual attraction and not the 1 Corinthians 13 definition of love. And then marriage, they've redefined marriage too, in this idea of like men marrying men and women marrying women. They've redefined love, they've redefined marriage, right, to not to be the biblical. Okay, next, moving on here. Critical race theory. So now we have critical theory being applied for race. And you just see here in all of these, even though there's some truth, they're using them as a wedge to just divide and to destroy. All right? So this is what critical race theory teaches. They say that this is the white supremacist mindset. Being white is the norm, and all other races are abnormal. And they use that term races, which in Scripture there's no such thing even. There's ethnicities. There's one human race. There's different ethnicities. Therefore, being white is superior, and all other races are inferior. This is what the white supremacist mindset teaches according to critical race theory. Now, is this true? It's true. Lots of people, you can look in history, you can see this is true. This has happened. This happens today even. The postmodern mindset, though, says this. The white majority has constructed the idea that being white is ideal. It's ideal in order to perpetuate its own power and to suppress those who are not white. And again, there's some absolute truth in that. We can look and see that that's taken place. So the social justice, the applied postmodern mindset, is therefore we must now devalue whiteness and promote other races in order to equalize the balance of power. So one example of this is Black Lives Matter, and I have the sign up here. And again, the statement itself is non-controversial. Every Christian should believe that Black Lives Matter. All right? The question is, what does Black Lives Matter, the organization, believe? All right? Because if you put a sign up in your front that says Black Lives Matter and not thinking about it, it would be you're promoting a certain organization whether you think you are or not. All right? Or you run the risk of promoting an organization, whether you mean to or not. The statement itself is neither controversial nor problematic from a Christian perspective. In fact, every Christian ought to be able to emphatically say that Black Lives Matter. Black BLM, though, the movement, says this is what they say from their own statement. We affirm the lives of black, queer, and trans folks, disabled folks, undocumented folks, folks with records, women, and all black lives along the gender spectrum. Our network centers are for those who have been marginalized within black liberation movements. All right? They're focused on what they say is black liberation, but from queer, trans, disabled, undocumented, all of that. All right? So they lump it all together. They're not, and notice it doesn't say anything about unborn. It just talks about the other things. They're focused on one group. They also, on their websites, support the expansion of abortion services in the black community and are proponents of defunding the police. They also reject the statement "all lives matter" because of its concept of a zero-sum system. They believe it's a zero-sum system. In order for one group to be raised up, all these believe the same thing. You have to raise the other group. You have to pull the other group down, because there's a zero-sum system in their way of thinking. They also have a different definition of racism. It's not prejudice based on race. In other words, it's not somebody who's prejudiced towards someone else just because of their race. And that's how the dictionary currently defines it. Rather, it's prejudice plus power. So in other words, those in a minority group cannot be racist, according to their own definitions. Right, only the majority group can be racist. Right, and we know that's not true. Therefore, people of color or those of any minority status cannot be racist because their group lacks institutional power. So again, they've changed the definition to let people off the hook. Scripture's clear on that. No one should be a racist. Christians should absolutely not be racist. Right, but if you base it on their definition, every white person is a racist just by being white. and every minority can't be, no matter what their thoughts are, no matter what they actually say and do. And this is based on their own writings, okay? So you can look at that and see. So this calls for Christians to be thoughtful, because in each one of these things, we're going to pull out the parts that are true. There's true things. That's something to grasp onto, you know? Dominant cultures have oppressed subdominant cultures, right? We have done that. We can see, even as far as race goes, you know, ethnicities, we've done that as a nation, and we shouldn't do that. Okay, continuing. Feminist study, and I'm going to have to fast forward this here. If you've heard the term patriarchy, that's where that comes from. They say that women are a subordinated class that exists to support men. The male-led patriarchal system exploited the women for their own benefit. Postmodern mindset then says the male oppressor has constructed this idea that being male is superior in order to perpetuate its own power and to suppress those who are not male. The social justice mindset then comes in and says, therefore we must now devalue maleness and promote the feminist gender in order to equalize the balance of power. That's what we see taking place. Though the term feminism in its most basic definition simply means belief in gender equality, which we would agree with, it has come to mean an idea which places the value, opinion, and rights of women over men. And you can think of the Me Too movement. Me Too movement said what? Believe all women, just because they're women. Whatever they say, you have to believe them. All right? Which, of course, is not biblical justice, because biblical justice says that, no, you're not supposed to show partiality. You're supposed to weigh accurately and evenly. They also say that women are in charge of their bodies, which sounds great. We would agree with that, right? I mean, if a woman wants to get a wart removed from her finger, we shouldn't stop them. I mean, but that's not what they mean, is it? Right? They're not in control of their bodies. They want to destroy another body. All right? Okay, continuing on here, disability and fat studies. So this one focuses on handicaps, whether it's being overweight, obese, or disabilities, right? And I'm going to paraphrase this so we don't completely run out of time. Basically, they say those who are healthy in whatever way, shape, or form have dominated those who are not healthy, whether it's obesity or disabled, all right? So they come and say, now those who are obese, those who are disabled in some way, they need to be valued, and those who are healthy and in good, you know, have all their functions and capacities need to be devalued, right? So much so, this has gone to such an extreme that if a doctor tells an overweight and a morbidly obese person that they need to lose weight, that he is actually oppressing that person by trying to destroy a fat person, all right? So if someone has a bad arm and a doctor can fix it, then that doctor is destroying this disabled person. I mean, it's gone to that absurd lengths, right? But using all these things. And so when it says disabilities are respected, you see the signs and they'll say disabilities are respected. This is where that comes from. And it doesn't, they mean it itself. They mean not that the disabled person needs to be respected, but that the disability itself needs to be respected. Right, so that heaven for us is, if you're born without an arm or you lose an arm in this life, you're going to have a new arm in heaven. But nope, that's not what they would say. I mean, they wouldn't even believe in heaven, but they would say that person is just fine the way they are, and you should
don't
not.
You think, though, that there's millions of people, they don't think that deeply.
No, most people don't.
They never get to that point.
Right.
Except for people that are running those organizations that are all about the wrong way of looking at it.
Right. Except people jump on board because they see the signs, and then they label. If you're like, oh, time out. Let's stop and think about this for a minute. We need to think about where we're heading with this. Mm-hmm. And then you're considered, now you're an oppressor.
Sure.
See?
Sure.
Okay. And then finally we get intersectionality. So I just listed off this group, post-colonial theory, the queer theory, the feminism, the gender studies, the critical race theory, and the fat studies, disability studies. The more you can check off of these, so in this system, if you are a subdominant culture and you are a minority, and you are disabled, and you are a female who's transgendered, you are moving up the hierarchy of, because you're going down the oppressor group, because you get to check off more of these that I just read off here. So you're moving down, but in the system, you're moving up higher, right? So you have more claim to be heard, more claim to your rights, because you're so-called in the system more oppressed, all right? And we see that's what's taking place now in our culture, right? All the while, these people say that we can't really know what truth is. So like underlying all of this is this assumption from postmodernism that truth is just subjective anyway. I mean, all truth. There is no objective truth. So it's ironic that people are so confident today that they know truth and that this is the way things should be when there really is no foundational truth, so they're not even consistent. Again, I agree with you. Most people don't think this deeply. Most people aren't thinking, but they're being taught this in every way. So I'm going to wrap this up here with a few thoughts here. First of all, Ibram Kendi, in his book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, says this. An anti-racist does not mean opposition to racism in the traditional sense. This is what he says. So if you've heard the term anti-racist, and I included this for a reason. He says, there is no neutrality in the struggle against racism. The opposite of racist is not racist. It is anti-racist, he says. One either believes, well, I'm going to skip past that. So basically he says, one either allows, here, I'm going to start here. There is no in-between safe space for not racist. To be truly anti-racist is to be feminist. To be feminist is to be anti-racist. We cannot be anti-racist if we are transphobic or homophobic. In other words, to be an anti-racist, from the definition of anti-racist, is you have to include everything we just talked about here in it. So you can see they've lumped in everything. So that in order to follow the system, you have to be equally for all the things. And we have to be wise and say, well, what does Scripture say? All right? And there's legal groundwork being laid for this. Laying the groundwork, check this out, for dignity harm to replace material harm as a legal standard for prosecution and punishment by the state. So material harm is somebody actually comes up and punches you. Somebody actually comes up and takes your car, steals your such and such. Dignity harm says this. Number one, treating people as inferior regardless of whether anyone recognizes the mistreatment. Two, causing people to feel inferior intentionally or not. Three, contributing to systemic moral inequality intentionally or not. Now, what we're getting into here now, do we have the freedom to say as Christians, such and such is a sin? Not according to this, because just saying that to someone else, if this continues on and infiltrates into the legal system, which it now is, we won't even be able to say that. We can't even say that we have a truth. Just saying that will be considered the same as a physical, material harm to someone. Marxist Antonio Gramsci said this, and he lived 1891 to 1937. He said, printed up here. Socialism is precisely the religion that must overwhelm Christianity. In the new order, socialism will triumph by first capturing the culture via infiltration of schools, universities, churches, and the media by transforming the consciousness of society. Right? Now, his idea of socialism didn't include all the stuff that we have just talked about. Right? So this isn't a class that's just anti-socialist. It's anti-socialist based on all the stuff that's being included in that. West German student leader Rudy Dutschke, 1967, he reformulated Gramsci's statement with the phrase, the long march through the institutions. And that's what we've seen today. Karl Marx thought, he believed that there was going to be an immediate uprising of the people. As soon as the oppressors realized that they were oppressed, there was going to be this instant uprising. Well, Gramsci here said, no, I don't think that's how we're going to succeed. I think we're going to succeed, what does he say? By capturing the culture through infiltration of schools, universities, churches, and the media. by transforming the consciousness of society. And that's what we see taking place, right? So when you're talking with someone else and you hear some echoes of these things, especially when, well, that's just your truth, right? That's just your truth. That's where all of this comes from, all right? And so, again, I had to leave out a lot and I had to condense a lot of this here, but hopefully that gave you a foundation. And if you're interested, here's a book, Understanding Postmodernism, that you can check out if you want. James K.A. Smith has a book called Who's Afraid of Postmodernism, where he encourages using postmodernism in positive ways. And you can read that one too. There's other materials you can read.
Most defeating, isn't it? To feel that you can make a difference.
Yeah.
For all, I mean, it's everywhere out there.
Right.
It's really hard.
Yeah.
I agree with when you said that the damage that will be done would be so much that it would be kind of a generation that would be lost, except especially when you have to redefine a lot of stuff.
Right.
That were based on fact and science, and now the same place with in medicine, when you have a test to affirm that based on the protein, based on certain things you see X and Y,
right.
That this is a male, this is a female. Now you're saying, well, because you have X and Y chromosome, you can't say, well, you are a male, because you have XX, you're female.
Right.
Now it's blurred. That's when it's headbutting with medicine, because that doesn't make sense.
Right. Well, but I'll just say here real quick to what you just said, that they would argue, well, see, you're confusing sex with gender. So gender is your, what you identify as, what you feel like you are, what you believe you are. Sex, yeah, sure, that's what your body is. And so, like what you're describing, sure, that's somebody's sex, but that's not their gender.
Right. They're talking about sexual orientation.
Right. But what they're meaning is, well, sexual orientation would mean more like, are you attracted to a man or a woman? The transgender would be a man whose sex says he's a male, but he feels like he's a female. And they would say that's gender. But see, then again here, now you start redefining terms. And see, they're actually playing the game that they say has been played by redefining terms to match their worldview. But again, I just read in Colossians. I mean, that's what Satan does, right? And so we just stand for truth, but we need to be aware of it too. So I went over time here.